Hey, it's Zach. In this episode, the great Kevin Arnovitz and I chat about the Western Conference playoff race at the top and at the bottom. Please take a minute to subscribe to the podcast. Give it a rating. 5 stars would make me very happy. Leave a nice review. And before we get to today's episode, I want to remind you about another great NBA podcast, The Hoop Collective, with friend of the program, Brian Windhorst. In the latest episode, Brian, Jackie McMullen, that's Hall of Famer Jackie McMullen to you, and Tim McMahon discuss Kyrie Irving's return and the Houston Rockets' recent struggles. You can find The Hoop Collective wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to a Thursday afternoon Low Post podcast that officially marks, semi-officially, the halfway point of the 2019-2020 NBA season. And it's time to take stock of some of the key playoff groupings and playoff races. And we're going to start in the Western Conference. And I can't think of anyone better to talk about this with, and particularly the first team we're going to hit, than my friend and collaborator, the great Kevin Arnovitz. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Doing very well. Always so grammatically on point. The first team we have to talk about is a team near and dear to both of our hearts, the residents of the Grindhouse. And maybe I'm hesitant to say they're the best story in the NBA this season, but they're one of the best stories in the NBA. The Memphis Grizzlies are 19-22, 13-6 in their last 19 games, and they are the eighth seed in the Western Conference if the proverbial season ended today. Nobody saw this coming. Not me, not you, not Taylor Jenkins, who should be a candidate for Coach of the Year. Not Robert Parra, the owner of the Memphis Grizzlies, wherever he is. Not Justin Timberlake, not Peyton Manning, nobody. I'm not sure they can keep it up. Obviously, they're quite a young team. They have played 23 home games and only 18 road games, so some pain is perhaps coming, in terms of schedule, although their schedule has been, you know, relatively normal, average. It's not like they've had an easy schedule. They are, for the season, 15th in offense and 22nd in defense. In the last month, they are third in offense. The Memphis Grizzlies have the third best freaking offense in the NBA in the last month and still 22nd in defense. So that defense is the reason for skepticism. Mr. Arnovitz, what do you make of this other than they're well coached and they have They have several very good young players, including a flat out star in Ja Morant. What do you make of this team?
So it's really interesting because what they're doing is, first of all, I mean, let's start with the first thing, which is that I've come to believe that not having your draft pick presents all kinds of cool incentives for you to do well. And like, we saw this with the Nets, and now we're seeing this with the Grizzlies. And I'm somebody who actually does believe, look, exploit the incentive structure when you can. If there is no incentive for winning, why should you win? But I do think it's liberating for a team because now they don't have to worry about, oh, well, these veterans might make us semi-competent, or what are we going to do, or the protections are this. Like, they sort of have conceded that they are playing to win and to establish the culture, and that's what they're doing. The thing that's most interesting from just on the court standpoint is Jenkins comes in, and he does have this interesting constellation of really young guys – and then veterans who may or may not want to be there or playing for their next deal.
Well, one who's literally not there.
Ooh, Iguodala.
Yes.
Yes, who is in the Bay Area taking VC meetings or just kind of staying in shape. But, I mean, but that's sort of representative, right? I mean, and from the outside looking in, it's like, okay, here's this veteran champion, and does he want to be slumming in Memphis? But tactically, and I mean, you're watching it, it's this really interesting Budenholzer or Pop even junior offense, right? Because so much of it is predicated on reading the court, right? Like, there's not a lot of structure, because the truth of the matter is, in this day and age, we are never going to see another offense in the NBA where sets are just commandeered on the sideline, possession after possession, right? Like, the NBA, like, the Mike Dunleavy is not walking through that door, right? And so, but here's the problem. You're going to ask now a bunch of 20-year-olds, you know, Dylan Brooks, another young guy, to run a read-and-react offense when they haven't really learned to read yet because they were playing at Murray State and wherever else in Oregon less than like a year or two ago, right? And yet, what they've been able to do is make it both intuitive but also easy. And so, first of all, they're just going to fly in transition. But even in the half court, like, I was watching the game against Houston the other night, And it's amazing. Like, you can see these moments where they're not getting what they want. And the way it sort of works there is, if you're not getting what you want, Ja or Dylan, or, you know, even JJ sometimes has the ball, and they run these kind of four fives, pick and rolls, which is really fun. What they'll do is just say, hey, go play with a teammate. Don't worry about this intricate system. Just go, like, if you don't find what you want, go play with a teammate. Do it quickly, because they're only 24 seconds. It's an inconvenience of the modern game, right? But, hey, dribble handoff, middle pick and roll, you know, run some other kind of quick action with your nearby teammate, and they're generating good offense out of it. And then you throw in Valanciunas. So a guy that, like, what do we need him for? He's an old school five. You know what you need him for? Is once or twice a week, Phoenix is going to come in, or Washington is going to come in, or Sacramento is going to come in, and these teams cannot protect the rim. And so you feed that guy, and it's not an everyday thing. He's not the five of their future 4 years down the road. But in the meantime, by the way, there is a game for you every single week that is for the taking, because that guy will brutalize your non-existent rim protection.
Yeah, he'll throw up a 30 and 15 every four games.
Right. And by the way, that's how you build a six-game win streak, because, like, two or three of those games are gonna be against teams with just crappy interior defense, and you've got an advantage there. But I just kind of love it. I mean, I think the great – and we talk about it every time we talk. I mean, the great tension in the NBA is, how do you balance structure and freedom, right? It's actually the great – it's the great debate of any civil society, right? Like, how do you
wow. –
how do you negotiate structure and freedom? Because the game is never going to be wholly structured ever again. I mean, maybe it happens. I mean, I don't know. There are always cycles. But, like, you're just not going to have more than a handful of sets each quarter from the sideline. You know, hands up, you're running this. It's always going. Well, there's going to be.
That's what frustrates Brett Brown so much in Philadelphia. And he's talked to me about this on the record. It's in stories. He calls himself, he feels like a waiter, that he's ordering dishes possession by possession, because his team is so weird and complicated and has a point guard who won't shoot and an old school low post guy and like five power forwards. And he feels like it's not working unless A, they're sprinting with Simmons, in which case it's easy, or B, he's calling every set and it's like, Ben, you've got to stand there and you've got to stand there. And to your point, I think one of the joys of the NBA is watching the Bucks when Giannis is not in the game. And Mike Budenholzer, and that's not a slight on Giannis. I love watching Giannis. He's the most watchable player in the NBA. He's going to dunk on everyone and try to kill them. But Mike Budenholzer's DNA is all over the Grizzlies, because when Giannis is not in the game, the Bucks have a general structure, which is as many people on the perimeter as possible when we start doing stuff, including you, Robin Lopez. You're going to be in the corner or somewhere. And if you watch the Grizzlies, one of the big guys on the court is going to be in the corner on 80% of possessions. Brandon Clark is going to be in the corner, or Jackson's going to be in the corner. It gets a little more complicated when, you know, the dinosaur Valanciunas is in the game. And then from there, it's just like you said, it's just the Bucks is like a symphony of random screens and flares and give and goes and cuts. And like the players just all, it's just a bunch of smart basketball players making smart basketball plays until they shoot. And the Grizzlies are kind of like that all the time, except they're younger. And they're a little wilder, and they do have a legitimate Ja Morant belongs in the All-Star conversation right now. Ja Morant, now I'm not sure he deserves to make the team, but if you're listing your final 18 to 20 candidates for the 12 Western Conference spots, he should be on it. Like, if Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Chris Paul are on it, Ja Morant, his rookie season is so impressive on like 500 different levels, the first of which is, most point guards are bad when they're rookies, period. Like, Chris Paul's good rookie year is one of the major outliers in NBA history. What Ja Morant is doing is winning basketball. These are not like empty rookie numbers where guys just put up numbers because they're on a bad team. He's playing winning basketball right now. You mentioned that Houston game. That Houston game had like seven Ja Morant, I just jumped off my couch moments with his vision.
This morning, Zach, I queued up all the Ja Morant assists from that game. Not the scoring, which he did plenty of. It is unbelievable. I mean, look, like you, I didn't watch much Ja Morant in college because I don't make a habit of watching Murray State when I'm trying to keep up on 30 NBA teams during a regular season. And I had no idea his instincts were this good.
Oh, my God.
I had no idea. And it's not just look, if you just love basketball and you're not a dork like Zach and me, I mean, you could just watch this guy sheerly for spectacle, right? Like, they're going to be ridiculous plays in transition where he looks off one open teammate because there's actually an equally open but less obviously open teammate over there.
You know what? And, you know what he does?
Throw it up for Brandon Clarke. Yeah?
He sees every pass, but it's not only that. He sees passes that don't exist yet, but he knows if I dribble this way, then that pass is going to open up. Or if I do a crossover here and then hesitation here, that guy's going to come open. So he's not just seeing all the available passes. He's seeing the passes that are not available yet, but he knows how to make them available. That's like sixth-year advanced point guard manipulation, and he's doing it now. This dude is a flat-out star. Rookie of the year is over. Zion has to average like 30 a game for the rest of the season to make rookie of the year a race. Other than that, and even then, I think it's probably over. This guy's a star. And you mentioned Dylan Brooks. I love watching Dylan Brooks.
I want to say one more thing about Ja.
Yes.
Which is the most exciting second in basketball in the 2019-20 season is when Ja Morant elevates in the air and you don't know where the pass is going. And every once in a while it's a disaster, but increasingly with each passing week in this season, it is going to do – that is my favorite second in basketball right now. Ja Morant in the air, the pass is going somewhere. I don't know where it's going. His teammates may or may not know where it's going, but increasingly they are knowing where it's going, and that's why they've gone from being, you know, that rough first month to the sort of this glorious past month.
They're a top five league pass team right now. The only team in the league, to your point earlier, who is not enjoying the Memphis Grizzlies is Boston, who owns their top six protected draft pick and thought they were looking at either the seventh pick or it rolls over to the following season when it will be unprotected. And now they don't even know if they're getting a lottery pick.
It's funny, like this happened last year, right, with Sacramento.
They are the Grizzlies. They are the Kings.
Schlocky team, right. Every year they own a schlocky team's pick, and then every year that team overachieves. And like, meanwhile, you know, Sac is back in the doldrums. So like, they get the 1 year out of eight where the team's semi-competitive.
Now let's zoom out because the Grizzlies are eighth, but this is a legitimate seven-team race for the last playoff spot. The Thunder are seventh with a four-game cushion. I think if they stand pat, they should be fine. And all the buzz as of now is that they're going to stand pat with their key guys. But who knows? That could change. I mean, Dennis Schroeder is interesting, and like, they have so much depth at that position that that's the one I could see maybe they move. But I haven't heard much Gallinari buzz. I think teams are calling about Gallinari and not getting anywhere. So let's just say Thunder in for now. That leaves literally every team in the conference other than the Warriors within four games of the Grizzlies. So it goes Grizzlies, Spurs tied in the loss column, then Portland, Phoenix two games back in the loss column, then Minnesota, who made a trade today right before this podcast, which we can get to, and then the Pelicans and the Kings four games back in the loss column. But as you surely know, the Pelicans, A, are getting Zion back, and B, have by far the easiest schedule in the Western Conference going forward. And they've played 19 home games and 22 road games. So it's not just that their schedule is easy qualitatively. They also get more home games. 538's playoff odds have the Pelicans as by far the most likely team to get. Let me bring them up. They have the Pelicans as like a 45% chance to make the playoffs or something insane like that, considering that they're four games back on the loss column. They have the Pelicans at a 40% chance to make the playoffs.
And wow.
It's actually one of the more interesting discrepancies. They have the Pelicans at 40%, the Grizzlies only at 12%, the Spurs at only 6%. And then you look at Basketball Reference, and I've never seen a discrepancy like this. If you look at Basketball Reference, it's like totally the opposite. The Spurs are the favorite. And I talked to some 538 people, and they said their model just loves the Pelicans roster. It understands it's getting Zion back. It's weighting preseason expectations a lot. So seven teams, one spot. I mean, who in this group do you have faith in? Let's leave Memphis aside. Well, you include Memphis if you want. Who is like a serious contender for this spot in your mind? Who do you look at to say, okay, I'm confident that game 75, they're still in shouting distance, or they have this spot?
So the obvious answer, for me at least, is Portland, in the sense that I just feel like they probably have a nice four-week stretch of basketball at some point. Last night's game against Houston, if you want to look for an indicator, looks pretty good. They've also have, I think, four home games in hand. So, you know, right now, I mean, a place I like to go for purely unscientific prognostication is I look at a home, I think this is the old George Karl thing. Like, I look at the road wins versus the home losses as a general. That doesn't account for which teams are left or whatever else. But, the Blazers have 9 away wins and they have 10 home losses and they still have, like, I think 4 home games in hand. So I like them. The historic answer would be the San Antonio Spurs. I think of those teams, they have the best win differential, a point differential. So if that's a predictor of quality, which it often has been, you might go with the Spurs, to say nothing of the fact that they'll figure out a way. There are 3 vets on that team who are reasonably capable.
They have the best net rating of all these teams, which is a slight minus. They're up to 10th in offense, which we'll talk about, and they remain 21st in defense. So a profile not unlike Memphis's profile for the season. So Portland and the Spurs, what else?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm pessimistic about the Suns for no other reason than, I mean, by the way, it's the opposite with them. I think they have 6 more away games than home games remaining.
They
actually share that 1 point minus 1.2 with Spurs. They are the other answer to who is the best net rating team among them. But I just, I don't like to see a team with 6 more away games than home games.
Let's hit the Suns real fast. They're 13th in offense, 19th in defense, and net rating actually is almost equivalent to the Spurs. However, as you said, they have all those road games coming up, 6 home games in hand, which is the biggest split in the league. They have the hardest remaining schedule, regardless, whichever one of those you prefer, of the location of the game. So it's like doubly hard. And they're 2-13 against teams 500 or better so far this season. Only Minnesota among these teams is worse. Minnesota is an absolutely disgusting 2-15 against those teams. So the metrics are just screaming the Suns are not going to be in this race at the end of the year. Now, maybe that's true, maybe that's not. I have one interesting thing I do want to say about the Suns. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
I've had this debate with a few people inside the league in the last week. I think it's really interesting that they're not starting Ayton. Last week, they, I think, played 3 games, maybe, with Baines and Ayton in the starting 5. That group was actually a slight plus. I wrote about it in 10 things that I didn't like it and didn't think it was going to be a real lasting thing. My assumption was when they break that group up, they will start Ayton. And now they're starting Baines. Now they've closed some games with Ayton in small ball lineups that have done quite well. I think that takes a lot of balls. And some people agree and some people disagree and say, well, Baines has just been better this year. They won so many games with Baines, blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, Ayton was the number one pick in the draft. You passed up Luka Doncic, even though you had the head coach of the Slovenian national team as your coach, to pick DeAndre Ayton. I don't care if Monty Williams has so much juice there, he can do whatever he wants. It still takes guts to bring that dude off the bench, and I think it's really interesting. Now, I know he just got suspended for 25 games. He's only played like 6 games or whatever since he came back. I get all that. I just think it takes guts as an organization to not just hand him the starting job. And frankly, if we're like 10 or 15 games down the line and he's still not starting, I'm going to be like, whoa, that's kind of interesting, because most bad teams, you're the number one pick in the draft, you're starting, and the Suns are maybe not a bad team, but their record is bad.
I mean, is Monty one of those people who sends a message through lineups? And that's the question. And is it a commentary on defensive effort? I don't know. That's just purely, I want to repeat this for the aggregators. That is purely speculation. I'm looking for possible explanations as to why. And by the way, another explanation is, as you say, this is his extended training camp, right? The team has established a certain rhythm defensively and offensively. I thought they played pretty damn good defense the first 6 weeks of the season. This is about sort of getting up to speed. This is, again, extended training camp. That is another explanation. I don't know. Or it might just be, hey, look, DeAndre, build him up. He can just decimate second units. Not unlike what we talked about with Valanciunas. He can just absolutely just kind of go. It's sort of a great preliminary part of the season for him. And at a certain point, there'll be parity between him and Baines. And at some point, he'll start closing. And then at a certain point, he'll start opening. And we're playing the long game in Phoenix, and we shall not dwell on. I mean, that is the only explanation I have. I don't disagree with the move offhand.
No, I just think it's atypical. That's why it's Aaron Baines is starting over the number one pick in the draft from two drafts ago. I just think it's atypical. That's all.
Although the Sacramento went through this, right? Where Bagley, and in fact, it was a major point of friction where Bagley is, and now that's a rookie season, so you know you might say it's a different ball game, but where Bielitsa, you know, had to start over Bagley, who was still playing, by the way, like 34 minutes, but there was some sort of symbolic.
Bagley has and had some positional vagueness, right? Where there was disagreement within the Kings about whether he should be a four or a five, or whether he was ready to play the five. Like, there's none of that with Ayton. He's a five. Like, this idea that he and Baines were going to play together was lunacy. It was never going to work.
I
will say, if you ask me to list the 10 players I'm most interested to watch in the last 40 games of the season, Ayton would be somewhere on that list and probably toward the top. He's his strengths are very obvious, right? He has unbelievable hands. He's a crazy good offensive rebounder. He's not a bad passer. He can score. Defensively, he's got a ways to go, although when he's a straight five, he's getting like a little bit better. When they were asking him to guard like the Bielitsas of the world, he was totally out of his depth. How many free throws do you think Ayton has taken this year? Take a guess. In 10 games, he's played 10 games. How many free throws do you think he's taken?
How many free throws has Ayton taken? How many games has he played? Remind me.
10.
What? 35?
13.
He's taking 1.3 free throws a game as an offensive big in this league. How is that possible?
When you talked about his defense and Monty being maybe concerned about his defense and purely speculative and all that, his defense, but I get that. That's going to be a while. It's defense in the NBA is hard for a big guy with limited college experience, all this. That free throw stuff, like when I watch DeAndre Ayton play and he's not getting offensive rebounds aside from those possessions, which he's elite at, all he seems to want to do is catch the ball on the left block and take a spinning fadeaway jumper like he's Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant 15 years ago or 20 years ago. And it's just like every time Andrew Wiggins would take a pull-up 20-footer, I would literally be like, ugh. And now I'm like, when he goes into that spin, I'm already like slouching and rolling my eyes because there's another miss and no free throws. And I'm like, dude, you're huge. Just go to the basket. What are you doing with these 15-foot, 18-foot fadeaways to nowhere? Anyway, that's my
right.
Deion.
You can learn a thing or two from Jonas Valanciunas.
He'll
never be as mechanical as Jonas, and that's a good thing probably, but yeah.
So unfortunately, we have the same answers to the who do you have faith in to be in this. So if I had – the Grizzlies to me are a wild card because it's just so hard to figure out like how real is this when their schedule gets a little tougher, how real is it? Spurs, we'll talk about. I have faith in them. How could you not? The Blazers, 18-24, have frankly just been consistently bad all season, ravaged by injuries. So they have a built-in – it's not even an excuse. It's a reason for being bad. Their roster is decimated by injuries across the board, but they just haven't had a stretch of basketball that makes you feel good about their team. Phoenix, I don't have a lot of faith in. Minnesota, I don't have a lot of faith in. New Orleans, because of their schedule and the impending return of Zion and their friskier play over the last month, I do. And then Sacramento, we can get to. So I don't have a lot of faith in Sacramento, although they're interesting. So I agree with you. Let's talk about the Spurs. The Spurs have made the playoffs 9,000 years in a row. They are very much aware of that streak. They do not want it to end. For the season, let me bring up my Spurs stats. For the season, they are 10th in offense, 21st in defense. Since December 23rd, they are 2nd in offense and still not very good on defense. Do you know what happened on December 23rd?
I do not know.
LaMarcus Aldridge started shooting threes. And I spoke to LaMarcus Aldridge about that this week. Spoiler alert for something I have coming out. But I assumed that there was some come-to-Jesus moment with Pop and him and whoever else is involved in these meetings that I imagine take place, but apparently did not. And because the contrast between before and after that date is so stark that I just thought something has had to have happened to make him do this. And no, he just decided I'm going to shoot threes. Like, I'm ready. Going to do it. Since then, with DeRozan and Aldridge on the floor, which has been a black hole of suck for 2 years in a row, they are scoring 124 points per 100 possessions, which would be number one in the league by so much it's not even worth looking up. DeRozan has gone berserk, like absolutely berserk. I think he's scored over 20 points on over 50% shooting like 10 games in a row, just berserk. And they just got kind of more interesting again. And if LaMarcus is really going to shoot threes like that, A, it helps DeRozan because the lane is clear for him. B, it helps all these other Murray and White types who want to drive into the mid-range and take floaters and all that. It gives them some theoretical possibility to play Poeltl and Aldridge together more than they have this season, which is almost not at all. They're interesting, and they just have the track record of, you know, they're not going anywhere. Like, they're not bailing out of the season as long as Pop is there. And they're rarely, if ever, going to beat themselves. They're first in the league in turnover rate, lowest turnover rate. They don't foul. They do all this stuff. And now they're like, shot selection is normal-ish. They have a very easy remaining, not very easy, but one of the easiest remaining schedules in the West. I think the Spurs board, if you put a metaphorical Nerf gun to my head right now and said pick one of these teams, I think I would pick the Spurs.
It's those non-metaphoric Nerf guns that'll get you. You know, it's funny. I'm also skeptical. I mean, this was just a born out of imagination that, hey, I'm no longer going to roost on the left block for 50 possessions a game, but it is necessary. And again, it's as much about, think about the guys who just subsist on that roster on driving lanes, right? I mean, DeMar, Murray, Derek White, to the extent that he operates as an offensive weapon, which he doesn't do very often. And it is essential, to say nothing of the fact that it's just more fun to watch. I've been kind of growing bored of, like, they're kind of the bottom of my league pass rankings in the past 18 months to 2 years.
Well, last night they're playing in Miami, and I'm watching this game because I might write something about the Spurs. And you want to know the impact of, like, you know, what does it mean that LaMarcus is floating around out there more? And it is a sacrifice on his part. And here's a demonstrable example of that. 20 times, I'll say 15 times, some large amount of times last night, the Spurs ran a middle pick and roll with Bryn Forbes screening for DeMar DeRozan. Because LaMarcus Aldridge is over in the corner. There's nobody in the lane. So they can use a little guy to screen for DeMar and present the defense with this choice of, you either switch Duncan Robinson onto him or whoever is guarding Bryn Forbes, or you hedge and recover or try and do whatever, and you're going to give him a crease. And if DeMar gets a crease, as antiquated as he is, as whatever as he is, as crappy on defense as he is, as net negative as he's been all these years, the dude is going to score buckets. And right now he's scoring buckets in a way that is helping them win games.
Yeah. I mean, the question then becomes, I mean, especially when you write about them, is can they defend? I mean, is it fair to say that if this team just defended at a league average level, you know, they've got the 7 seed and might even knock on the door, might even be able to put together 16 wins in 21 games. I mean, that's what's just so odd and dissonant about it all, right? And that's with the appreciation that DeRozan's never going to be an all-league defender. Actually, I thought Aldridge, when really motivated in Poeltl, was as good a pick-and-roll defender as there was among bigs in the league. You know, White can defend Murray. I think I had him on the all-NBA defensive team 2 years ago.
Murray, if I ride the subway with Murray, I'm holding on to my belongings, even if he's at the other end of the car. That guy is everywhere all at once. He's stealing entry passes where you're not even sure he's in the freaking TV picture. That guy is a menace.
So how do we get them to play league average defense?
I don't know. Playing Poeltl more would help. They started Poeltl in the second half of their recent game against Toronto alongside Aldridge. And I thought, okay, this is one of the options that is unlocked for Pop because LaMarcus is now willing to act like a perimeter player a little bit more. And then we saw none of that, against Miami last night. So I'm curious to see if that, because Poeltl has been frankly sensational defensively in limited minutes.
He always had gifts in Toronto defensively. I mean, maybe that's the answer. Zach, this is not so much about opening driving lanes for the DeJounte Murrays of the world, even though it certainly does that. What it does is it gives you better personnel potentially to actually win some games defensively, which, you know, they did for a while in San Antonio for like 20 zillion years. And I just wonder, you know, a seemingly offensive adjustment is really about the combinations it liberates defensively.
The wild cards here are obviously New Orleans. 4 games in the loss column and a bunch of teams to jump is not nothing. And I know their schedule is easy relative, speaking, and they're getting the big fella back. That's still not nothing. That's a lot of ground to make up. The buzz around the league, obviously New Orleans has, I would say, three coveted veteran trade candidates in Drew Holiday, J.J. Redick, and Derek Favors. Teams have talked to them. They've talked to teams. Talks have happened. Phone calls have been placed. The phones have been answered. We're still 3+ weeks out of the trade deadline. The buzz that most teams have come away thinking they're standing pat. They're looking at their schedule. All the other Louisiana sports teams are done playing. Focus is on the Pelicans. The Davis stuff is still sort of washing out of everyone's mouth there. Let's have fun. Let's try to make a playoff run. That's a 3-game losing streak away from changing, but right now, the best guess among other teams in the league is those guys are not going to be traded and they're going to make a run at it, that was always the most fun outcome here, is that the Pelicans trade Davis, they luck into Zion, and they're just this young, fast, ferocious, pain in the team to play against with like a crazy home court advantage because these local fans who are so mad about AD and so excited about Zion just go all in embracing this Lonzo running up the floor, hit ahead passes, Zion dunking on everyone, and they become this eighth seed that is just imagine if they got the eighth seed and they play the Lakers in the first round and they have these rabid crowds, and that's a scenario that would be that's in play. It's just they are now becoming a whole new team, and sometimes as exciting as it is to get a guy like Zion back, there is an 8-game, like, okay, we got to figure some stuff out. Ooh, we just took a loss. Ooh, another. It's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, they're fascinating because there are a lot of league average or better than replacement guys on that roster. I watched the last full Pelicans game I watched, actually was the J.J. Redick game winner at Sacramento, and watching that game. And yeah, I'm with you. I mean, what I hear is that, look, both Drew and JJ are on. They have 2 years left in addition to this year. One year left in addition to this year. So you can always get value for those guys in the offseason. There are going to be a lot of teams with a lot of needs next summer because there's not going to be a really overly active free agency. Just there's not enough money out there, and you can get value for those guys. Somebody is going to want a guy who can run around 40 curls a night and shoot at 39% from three, and J.J. Redick, who's a veteran leader, right? Like, somebody is going to want a Drew Holiday if he passes a clean bill of health, which he should. Favors is a more interesting case, but I'm with you. And again, it's one of those things where, yes, they have accumulated sufficient assets. I mean, yes, you can always use another future one, but if I'm New Orleans, you know, you're making a campaign for a market. You through no fault of your own, that your fan base has already had to wait an additional several months off of this initial excitement about the season. You know, your season ticket count increased because of this pick, and you want to sort of look. It can be really fun in a market to have a 11-week playoff run is really important in a market where basketball isn't king, where you are trying to sort of reformulate the image of the franchise in a community where you're coming off of the Davis thing. And I just think it'd be fun basketball. You know, and what's the worst that happens? What, you play yourself down from ninth pick to the 13th pick if you don't make it in a draft that frankly isn't all that deep? I think in terms of creating a narrative for the future, I think a combo veteran young player effort. In some ways, it's not unlike Memphis once Zion gets healthy, right? You have this interesting collection of veterans playing with these really intriguing young prospects who are exciting and really versatile. And so I kind of like it. And I think that makes the most sense.
Yeah, the only downside for trade Knicks is that if Drew Holiday isn't on the block at all, I just don't know who the guy is. That maybe there's a surprise guy somewhere, and that by guy I mean like someone who's really going to move the needle. Someone a team
right, who's, you're assuming Lowry's not going to be on, Holiday's not going to be on. Who else?
You know, right now the Raptors are fourth. You know, some people on other teams disagree with me. I think if they're fourth, fifth, within hailing distance of second, they're two games out of the loss column of second. I don't think they trade him. I think they ride it out. I just think it's too good. And I've been cautioning, you never know with Masai if they slide down to six, blah, blah. I guess Man, they're 26-14. They just got healthy. Actually, they're not quite healthy. They still don't have Van Vliet back. I just think you just gotta have a championship curtain call. And like, by the way, that curtain call might last a couple rounds. The way that depends on the seedings break. But yeah, your point with if not Lowry, if not Drew, you know, you have these teams. This is just my opinion. I'm not saying these are these teams' opinions of themselves. To be clear, you have teams like Miami, Denver, especially, who are one impact player away. Miami and Denver. I think you could argue Boston. I don't necessarily, like one impact player away from being really, really serious teams. And you search around for like, well, who is that player? And I come away kind of like, yeah, I don't know. And that's why Andre Drummond trade speculation, not for those teams, but for other teams, becomes this sort of topic. And then you have other teams like I think the Clippers are a lock to make some kind of trade. But I don't think they're going to be big game hunting. I think they're good enough that they're like a smaller player away, like a Marcus Morris level player away from being like they're already a serious team from being really, really serious. By the way, the Clippers, you know the Clippers better than anyone. There's so much hand-wringing right now about they've played down to their competition, and boy, they took a tough loss against Denver, and you know, they're not looking great. I'm like, wake me up when they actually don't look great with Paul George and Kawhi Leonard in the lineup. Like, every one of these disappointing games that everyone's fretting. Well, the Knicks, Memphis put up 140, they had to come back. I'm like, I don't care. Until it's the real team, I don't care. That's just my take on the Clippers. I think they're clearly the second best team in the West. Well, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say they're clearly the second best team. We're going to talk about that. But I'm not like – I'm surprised at like how much worry there is about the Clippers. Are you?
I tend to side with you on this just because I'm somebody who's come to devalue the regular season because the NBA devalues the regular season. And it's so clear that they don't care and the players don't care and they're willing to roll out this garbage product until we wait around for April. And so I'm with you. That said, I mean, I think this is the case for – a modicum of concern. Either you're somebody, and it sounds like you're one of these people, who looks, says, tell me what they are with these two guys on the floor. Oh, they're 14-4. That is a team that wins more than three quarters of a game. Factor that out. That's basically a 62-win team or something. Or you're somebody who believes that there are things we can glean about a team's DNA even when one of their two best players are off the floor. And if you want to cite an example, you know, maybe last year during the regular season, the Raptors were really good without Kawhi. And it was chalked it up as a sign of encouragement and that's great. That's a great story. Good for Fred VanVleet. Good for Kyle Lowry. But actually, maybe it told us something more profound, which is actually you can glean something about the overall essence of a team when one of those guys is down. And if you believe that, maybe you share a cost. Maybe you're one of these people who says, hey, that doesn't prevent them from playing world-class defense. What, you shouldn't, like, you're going to give up 140 points to Memphis on a Saturday afternoon at home? You know? I think that would be somebody who says, look, I'm not going to press the panic button, but I don't like what I see. That there's something in Coet about this so-called glory that we're supposed to believe is just there, embedded in their DNA, and we don't know what it is yet, and we still don't have enough information. And I think that is more than hand-wringing. I think that would be the argument of those people. I tend to be with you in that former group, but I understand the latter group, that you know there is something that is less than optimal about their performance with those two guys. And again, giving up 140 points to Memphis on a Saturday afternoon is not something that a championship team does. That, you know, you're not the LeBron Cleveland team in the East here. I mean, those have repercussions, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, they don't care about seeding. Oh, I think they care a little about seeding. I don't think you want to finish fourth in a conference, which I'm sure you're about to get to, by the way, that has a lot of teams that might finish ahead of you. Do you want to be the four seed?
4-5 right now is Clippers Rockets, which is just like, just break the internet now. I mean, that is a bloodbath of a first round series. And really, whoever 4-5 is going to be, it's going to be a bloodbath. Like, you want to get out of that series. You really want the second seed, which we'll talk about. But so the Clippers, like, I'm not unconcerned about the Clippers. Here's what it comes down to. They get like 85 to 90 points per game out of four guys, whatever it is. Like, they have four guys averaging 19 a game. Two of those guys you look at and you're like, well, okay, Lou historically, although this hasn't been as true the last couple of years, the playoffs get a little dicier for him, particularly on defense. And Harrell is an absolute monster, but the value of his effort relative to the competition, that gap is going to decrease in the playoffs when everyone is trying hard, and there are going to be nights when his size limitations at center are a little bit more glaring in the playoffs. And other than that, you just don't have a lot of juice. Like, Pat Bev has all sorts of juice, but not like I'm going to get buckets juice. And what you're really talking about is you want, even in your playoff rotation, you're getting a lot of minutes from the combination of your Harklesses and your Jermichael Greens, and there's a Pat Patterson sprinkling here, and Shamet comes in and is a little hit or miss, and Magruder comes in and is a little hit or miss. You're like, can we upgrade all that? Can we give all those minutes to Marcus Morris? If you can give like 75% of those minutes to Marcus Morris or an equivalent type of player, not a star, but like a really good fourth guy, then you're in business. And I think the Clippers, I'm shocked at how little Clippers trade buzz there is right now. Maybe I shouldn't be, considering they came like off the top rope from nowhere over the summer with Kawhi and PG, because they have their 2020 first round pick to trade. And after that, they can't trade a pick until after the world will have burned anyway. And they have Harkless's expiring contract. They have these assets that are just burning a hole in their pocket and have to be used. Like, I would be shocked if they got through the deadline and didn't make a trade, because they are all in. They're as all in as you can get, given what they gave up for PG and Kawhi. By the way, those guys are free agents in like 18 months. They're all in. They have to be all in, which brings me to my larger question of the other logjam in the West is 2, 3, 4, 5. And if you want to include the Mavericks at 6, they're only a game behind Houston. Maybe we should. I'm particularly interested, since we just talked about the Clippers, before the season, that Denver, Utah, Houston trio was like its own little trio. And everyone disagreed, or I had a lot of disagreements and debates, fun discussions about who was the best of those teams. Or more specifically, who by April 15th, when the playoffs start, is going to be the team among that group with the most championship equity, the team that you look and said, okay, they have put themselves into tier one. Maybe not as good as the Lakers and the Clippers, but you know what? They get into a playoff series with those teams. I think I wouldn't be shocked, wouldn't be like a colossal upset if they won. I still think that's an interesting discussion. So Denver, Utah, Houston, what's your answer to that question? April 15th, which of those teams has the most championship equity?
Oh, that is a really tough question. And I go back and forth on this. There are nights I watch Denver and I'm like, they got it, right? Like, is it ugly? I don't even care, because you know what? It just works. You have this great dribble handoff offense with a guard and Jokic, with some good second-sided action. You got Will Barton curling off a double screen, or like, I don't know, like, he's diving off a back screen or some zipper cut, and they set it up middle, and then there's this baseline action, and it's very simple, but it just works. And having a big man who can operate offense from the high post. Now, the counter to that is that's not what you want in the playoffs. I don't know where you are on this. This is a different conversation for a different day, but the greatest struggle I've had in the last 10 years is trying to negotiate the question, are the playoffs really different? Because – I mean, it's still 10 guys, and it's still fundamentally the same stuff, and it's still – but there is – I've come to believe, and I don't have any empirical evidence for this, that the playoffs are just different. I worry a little bit about, Gary Harris, and I know the injuries have been nagging. I mean, to me, he was always a really essential piece here, and I just think that, the health problems have sort of set him back. I mean, I still really like him as a defensive player. He's not the finisher he used to be. And that concerns me a little. I also wonder what they might have up their sleeve in a trade market. But I really, there are nights where I just love Denver. And then there are nights where I just worry about, is Murray really making anybody better? Even though I predicted Murray for the Rookie of the Year, I just love the pick coming out of Kentucky. And then you look at Utah, and we never have to be reassured about their defense. It is a well orchestrated machine, and now all of a sudden the shot creation is starting there. I mean, and Mitchell's just getting better, right? Like, he hasn't even really learned how to just sort of manufacture points out of bad possessions and just get to the line. Like, he's still learning that stuff. We never think of Utah as a young team, but their decidedly best player is very young and getting better rapidly. And I think, like, that's something to remember. And now I just love the way it looks with Bogdanović. And I say this as someone who always has an appreciation for Derek Favors, kind of a Georgia Tech guy. And, like, but there was something limiting in just watching, you know, that team try to just manufacture possessions, and sometimes it was just too hard. And I feel like it's gotten easier. And I know they're playing just great right now, and it's never as good as it is, you know, when you're on these streaks, and it's never as bad as it is that is for the first 6 weeks of the season with Utah every season. But God, I mean, that is a pick'em series for me. If you ended up with like a 2-3 Denver Utah, assuming the Clippers sort of, you know, can't surpass them, which I think they probably can. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those who's got game seven for me. I just, because there are times where I just really like the way it looks in Denver, and then there's times that I just don't know if I could trust this in May. I just don't know.
My pick to this question before the season, and you can go back and read my Tears of the NBA column that I write every year. My pick was Utah. I thought they had the best two-way potential of this group. And one guy, if he made a leap, I didn't think he was going to make a leap like some people expected. The words Dwayne Wade were thrown around, and I tried to throw cold water on that. But they have a guy in Mitchell who's exactly what you're describing as the guy the Nuggets don't have, a bucket getter. And his mid-range game has definitely taken a leap. And after a slow start, the Jazz are 11th in offense and 8th in defense. They have the number one offense in the NBA by far over the last month. Now, their schedule has been soft, but still, they've found their rhythm. I thought they had potential to finish the season as like a top six team on both ends of the floor. And that, to me, I had more faith in them doing that than Denver or Houston. Houston is exactly the team we thought. They're second in offense and 17th in defense. And if there's a red flag, it's that 17th. And look, Houston has the best player, okay, of between Houston and Utah. I just like Utah's team construction. Mitchell seems to be growing into his role as like, all right, I'm going to have to be the guy. Obviously, the question is going to be what happens when Conley comes back, because this whole entire run has coincided, A, with an easy schedule, B, with Conley being injured and Joe Ingles coming back into the starting lineup and Donovan Mitchell acting essentially as point guard. The reason I'm not as worried about Conley's return is this. Number one, their starting lineup was actually killing it. It's like one of the best lineups in the entire NBA. Now, that starting lineup didn't include Ingles. Ingles has played so well that he has to start. So if Conley starts, that's going to shove Royce O'Neal to the bench. That new starting lineup, which is Conley, Mitchell, Ingles, Bogdanović, Gobert, has a very limited sample size and has been mediocre. So maybe that's a case for being worried.
I don't worry about that, though.
I just think they'll figure it out. And if, by the way, if figuring it out means that Conley still struggles and they have to make him their backup point guard, like, they'll make that decision. I don't think that will happen. I don't think they want that to happen, but they'll make that. They have a track record now that says they can play that way. Part of the reason I'm not worried is, A, I still think Conley will figure some stuff out. B, their starting lineup was good even as he was struggling. And C, part of the reason they were so bad was that their bench was a train wreck. And between George Niang replacing Jeff Green, Tony Bradley figuring some stuff out, the addition of Clarkson, which I didn't love, and we can talk about that if you want, and one of these sort of six starters going into a bench role, I just think their team is going to even out. The performance is going to even out. I really like their team. I will say Clarkson is not the player type I would have gone for. They had one big chip to play, and that was Exum. And they had to attach picks, which is a little sad. And they went and got Jordan Clarkson. Now, there's been some speculation that part of the reason they got Jordan Clarkson was he makes $4 million more than Dante Exum, and they can now retrade him for a more expensive player. TBD, we'll see. I'm not sure that's the plan.
Not to get too granular. I mean, the one thing about sending O'Neal to the bench is, I mean, you tell me you've got three creators in a starting lineup and Conley, or playmakers in Conley, Ingles, and Mitchell. Kind of like one of those guys, and maybe you stagger it.
I think you just stagger
like
it.
One of those guys on the floor, with all due respect to Emmanuel Mudiay, or if you believe that Clarkson is somebody who can commandeer a second unit, I don't love it, but you know, then maybe you stagger those three guys. But I mean, I love, you know, those are just three creative players. Even Conley struggling is a guy who can, you know, is a guy who can sort of preside over a possession. You're going to get something.
I'm
hoping, like you are, that Mike comes back healthy. I'd love to see Mike Conley, the Mike Conley we know, on this team. Now, if you tell me we get the Mike Conley on this team, I take them over Denver. We would still need to hear about Murray's injury.
I don't hate the idea of Conley coming off the bench. I really don't. I realize that's politically unpalatable considering the money he makes and what they traded to get him. But you know what? Bringing DeAndre Ayton off the bench is politically unpalatable. They're doing it anyway.
I like O'Neal in the starting lineup.
I like him too.
In both starting lineups.
Well, what you just said about three creators is exactly the reason why Clarkson was not the player type I would have gotten. Now, I understand they just, like, we need some juice off the bench. We need a guy who can go get some buckets. He's changed his shot selection dramatically starting kind of in the middle of last year. He started taking more catch-and-shoot threes and getting to the rim more. But when they're fully healthy, Conley, Mitchell, Ingles, Clarkson is a lot of ball handling. And, like, it's cool to have a lot of ball handling. I just didn't think it was something that the apex version of their team needed more of. Now, maybe they're worried they'll never get that version, that Conley will never be the Conley they thought they were trading for. I always thought they needed one of those sort of 3.5 guys more than, you know, I've been beating the drum of Marcus Morris to Utah for a year and a half. They clearly don't agree with me. But I like their team. And Denver, A, Jokic is back, which is great. The guy is playing like an MVP candidate again after a slow, by his standards, first month. I just think for them to be serious, for them to be a serious contender, they need to get more out of Murray and Harris. And I just don't know. I mean, Jamal Murray is averaging 17 points a game, 4 assists a game, 32% shooting from three. Like, that's okay. It's okay. He's not even 23 yet. Like, it's awesome. He's going to be a great player. Gary Harris. It's been one of the underplayed stories in the NBA. Gary Harris's decline as an offensive player. He averaged almost 18 points a game 2 years ago. I don't know where that guy is. I don't know where he went. But I just don't.
I mean, I'll tell you where it went. I mean, Zach, there was the ankle and then the hip and then the hamstring.
Maybe that's all it is.
And you know, where I look at it is he's just not finishing the way. I mean, look, he's not shooting well from three, but he was a guy who used to be able to finish. And it's not. It's just not as – he just doesn't have that final – finish the way he used to. I love the contract. I like that they invested. I mean, I was rough on the Nuggets front office when it first took, like, I think 14 or 15. They made a lot of weird moves, and there was some, you know, and I've just been utterly impressed. Like, it is, they're, you know, in the evolution of any front office that became great, there was a moment where maybe they didn't know what they were doing. And I mean, they've been fantastic in identifying talent and play and evaluation, you know, and there are a lot of young guys competing for a lot of minutes, do a lot of the same things, and there's just not a lot of static. Like, I've been just completely impressed with Denver. And, but Harris, I just think it's kind of a sad story because, I mean, I don't think it's a lack of effort, right? It's just the hip, the hamstring, the ankle. It's just, it's been some bad luck.
I just think, like, Will Barton is – I think this season is just, I think he might be their best sort of perimeter bucket getter, and he's been great. That statement just makes me nervous. I'll tell you what, though. Everything they said about Michael Porter Jr., whoa, baby. That guy, that kid is good. You know, I don't know what the hell is happening with his body. I don't know what the status of all the red flags were, but that guy, he's figuring out some basic stuff about basketball, but he's good. He can shoot. They're calling ISO plays for him. He's abusing switches. He can offensive rebound. He cuts. Defensively, you know, he's still learning the game, but he has this sort of, like, baseline athleticism and speed to be a really good multi-positional defender. Maybe he's the answer, but I don't think he can be the answer in the conference finals or something. It's too soon for that, but that kid is good, and he looks like he has a chance to be really good.
Well, and again, and I mean, he's young. We forget how young Murray is. Jokic is still young. I mean, Jokic is one of those guys who looks like he'd be 51 or 19. It doesn't know. But like we realize they still have a really long runway. And that's really just, you know, kind of good news. I just still like them on a good night.
Their defense has slipped to 12th, which is mildly worrying because they were flirting with first for a while. I believe they're now 12th. I'm going to verify that as I'm talking, but that, you know, they allow a lot of threes and a decent amount of shots at the rim the way they play. They really have to be operating at full throttle. And the other guy we haven't talked about is, after an awesome start, Paul Millsap slowed down a little bit and got injured and has now been out of the lineup. And they're just not the same team defensively when he's not Paul Millsap. So I love their team. I picked them to win the West in the regular season, to have the number one seed going into the playoffs. So I clearly love Denver, but right now my answer to this question was Utah at the beginning of the season, and it's still Utah. But I'm not sure I'm picking any of those teams over the Lakers and the Clippers at this point. But the West is fun, man. Like, Like, we didn't even get to the Kings. Could you have any feel for what the hell the Kings are at this point? They've had the weirdest season in the entire NBA to me. I just can't figure out the Kings.
I don't know. It doesn't look like it did last season. It's not as much fun to watch. I mean, that's just a statement of aesthetics. I think they're just, and look, I'm not saying anything that a million other people haven't said here. It's a team that needs some velocity. Like, it is an inertia team. And it just, for whatever reason, they never have kind of orchestrated great half-court offense. They were able to mitigate that last season. This season, it rears its head again, and I don't know. I'm trying to think, what was it, the personnel moves?
They just haven't been able to get in a rhythm, and it started with the India trip. Then Fox got hurt. Then Fox got another injury again. Bagley got hurt. Now Bogdanovich is hurt. They're a team that, you know, and the Deadman thing fell flat. Now Holmes is hurt. It's just been like, I'd almost rather have everyone hurt at the same time and back at the same time than what's happened to their team. They just haven't been able to find an identity. And Fox is starting to ball again. That's great. But it just feels like they're kind of like in neutral, trying to figure out who they are. They have the talent to get back in this race for the eighth seed and even win it. It's just been a rough year. It continues to be a rough year. Just sort of figuring out what are we as a team, who should play with who, and all this. It's just slow. Time in the Western Conference. You know what's less fun is the Eastern Conference, 7-15, which is still as bad as ever. Did you see Kyrie's comments after the game last night?
I'm always trying to parse. I mean, they're almost unintelligible. I mean, is he saying that Joe Harris and Jared Allen can't play basketball? I was like looking, is it about the list? Was he being intentionally exclusionary of certain guys as a statement of disapproval? Is he just talking because, you know, there actually isn't much intentionality into what Kyrie Irving does? I mean, I think it's like one of the things we forget about, and this is true outside of sports, certain celebrities, certain politicians, whatever. Like, I think if you're somebody who's very intentional with your comments and your speech, you just never can absolutely grasp that, like, there are people in the world who aren't intentional in their comments, who just say and is there subtext? Yeah, presumably, if you dig deeply enough. But, I mean, I don't know. Like, if I were asking if this were an SAT essay, my day didn't even have essays. But, like, if you were doing this as reading comprehension, what would you glean?
Wait, we didn't have essays? And what year did you take the SATs? Did I not have an essay?
1841. No, I took the SATs in 90. There was, like, the English and the math, and that was it. And, like, the English was just, you know, vocab. You didn't have to write anything.
I didn't like antonyms. I didn't like antonyms. That was the section that scared me on the SATs. Anyway, look, so Kyrie said they need more pieces, and it's glaring that they need more pieces to complement them. Fine. Great. First of all, you have one big piece that's coming back next season who's the best player on the team. Second of all, I would assume Kyrie Irving conceives of himself as one of the 10 best players in the NBA. He's not, but I'm guessing he would conceive of himself as such. Kevin Durant is one of the 10 best players in the NBA until proven otherwise because of his Achilles injury. I hope he still is. I suspect he will be. If that's true and you have a decent supporting cast, how much more do you need in the East? How much more? Who scares you? You're scared of Boston? You're scared of the Bucks? The Bucks are awesome, but you're Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. You need more help? Against who? Against the Pacers? You need more help against Boston, your old team that you left? You need more help? Second of all, Tom Haberstroh tweeted it today. Brooklyn with Kyrie this season, 5-9. Brooklyn without Kyrie, 13-13. Boston with Kyrie last season, 37-30 without 12-3. You throw in the conference finals run the season before that, when they took Cleveland to game 7. All the Kyrie truthers will say, a small sample size, small sample size, small. Yeah, it's a small sample size. Life is a small sample size. Everything is essentially a small sample size until you go back to the freaking dinosaurs. It's all a small sample size. You know what it's not? It's not a tiny sample size anymore. It's not a statistically insignificant sample size anymore. And I am not saying Kyrie's teams are better without him. I'm not saying that. Because when it's nut-cutting time in the playoffs and it's a big moment and you need a big shot, you need a guy like that who can create shots. So I'm not saying that. What I am saying is there's a growing amount of evidence that Kyrie's teams are not worse without him. And for a guy who conceives himself as a top 10 player, that's not good. It must be nice. It must be nice, Kevin Arnovitz, for your teams to not miss a beat, really, when you're injured. For you to miss 25 games with a shoulder injury that your team, let's say, didn't, let's say at the minimum omitted the truth about. Come back, go 1-2 in your first three games, lose a game last night where you shoot 6 of 21, and then decide this is the appropriate time to say that the roster around me just isn't good enough.
Right.
What a nice life that must be.
Yeah, and this is what I would say, is if you are one of, and I would agree with you, I would imagine that Kyrie sees himself by sheer license of what he said, that he is one of the 10 best players in the league. Hey, guess what, man? It is your job to make those guys better. That's why, that is what makes you a top 10 player, right? So guess what? Here's Joe Harris. He's a 41.3% three-point shooter. Maybe you want to find him? Here's Caris LeVert, you know, a guy who, you know, sort of frankly commandeered the restoration of this franchise from futility, for better or worse. He's not a perfect player, but, you know, he's a piece. I mean, Taurean Prince, who's played exceptionally well at times. Like, and Spencer, say nothing about Spencer Dinwiddie, who, by the way, you know, might very well be a better floor general than you in this regard, because, you know, he's somebody who actually is semi-interesting in making his teammates better, even though he's, you know, probably doesn't have
two-thirds
of the talent that you have.
I want to put the brakes on it, because people are going to say, oh, dude, they're saying they're better without Kyrie. Kyrie's overrated. Well, I do think Kyrie's a little overrated. Number two, Boston's offense was way, way, way better with Kyrie on the floor. I suspect the numbers will show the same for Brooklyn right now. So, like again, in high-stakes playoff moments, I think his game has more value than it does in the regular season. All I'm saying is this. There's a growing amount of non-trivial evidence that his teams are not worse when he misses games. And B, just don't say that stuff. Like, just don't say it. You just missed 25 games with an injury the team didn't really, you know, fully tell the truth about. And you've been the team's bad since you came back. And you just went 6 of 21. Like, just don't go saying, like, oh, it's glaring, we need all this other talent. Just tell Sean Marks privately. That's all I'm saying. Have we not hit any team you wanted to talk about? Were you, like, dying to share any thoughts about the Wolves acquiring Alan Crabb?
No. I mean, let's check back in a couple months on Atlanta and some of our other kind of curiosities, teams that we just sort of keep tabs on. But I think this was very comprehensive.
The Wolves acquiring Alan Crabb is interesting only in that they saved a little bit of money and opened up a roster spot. They're not done. They're another team that I would be shocked if they were done. That's a trade to make another trade. That's a trade to get Jeff Teague out and to make another trade, because otherwise that doesn't make any sense.
Look, I know there are health concerns with Covington. You were looking for a 3-4 for Utah. Well, can I interest you in Rob Covington?
Everyone should be interested in Robert Bob Covington.
I love Covington.
All right, Mr. Arnovitz, I will see you in Los Angeles in about 10 days when I go back out there, and we will be at yet another Lakers-Clippers extravaganza, which are always fun, and the amount of celebrities in the house is just unbelievable. You have something coming out tomorrow, do you not?
I do.
Give us 2 minutes on that. What are we looking at?
A profile of Frank Vogel,
the Lakers head coach,
who was nobody's first choice, who sort of came through the side door in what was a public, strange hiring process for the Lakers. And right now, when you walk into the Lakers locker room or you hang around the facility, this might be the happiest place on earth. There is an air of absolute professionalism. The stars are pleased. Management is pleased. Ownership is pleased. It just hasn't felt this way in years. And so how did this guy, who was maybe their third choice, kind of take control of the situation, achieve what is seemingly is a perfect balance? It's early. Nobody wants to take victory laps. But Frank Vogel has, you know, a guy who, by the way, everyone had slated to be backstabbed by, you know, but you can have a conversation about that situation without alluding to Jason Kidd's waiting in the wings. And you know what? It is drama free. It is just, and they're doing the workaday task. This is a team that competes defensively. I can't remember the last time a LeBron team exerted this kind of defensive effort in the regular season. What, maybe the second year in Miami? You know, like, it's working. And so it's just a little insight into Frank Vogel and sort of what is working about it.
I'm curious to see if you get into this at all, and I look forward to seeing it on ESPN tomorrow. I think Vogel took all of that stuff that you just talked about, being the third choice, the Jason Kidd stuff, and all of this. He could have approached the job as if he were constantly under threat and paranoid and biting his tongue and afraid. Instead, he did the opposite thing, which I think was incredibly, incredibly smart, and also in his nature as sort of a good-natured, positive person. Frank is a very positive person. He's fun to be around, even when you're losing. He took it and said, you know what? I got this amount of years and this amount of money. Maybe I wasn't the first choice. Maybe they do have ulterior plans, whatever. Like, I'm just going to coach. I'm going to coach the way I want to coach, and I'm not going to worry about any of that stuff because the deal is the deal. My money's coming to me anyway. I have a chance to win big here. I have a chance to coach LeBron James. I'm going to coach like no one's watching. I'm going to coach him hard. I'm going to coach him hard on defense. I'm going to coach the team the way I want. And if it doesn't work out, that's fine. But I'm not going to let all this stuff scare me. I'm not going to let all of this stuff worry me. In fact, I'm going to use it to do the opposite. I'm going to coach with total intellectual freedom, total strategic freedom, total emotional freedom, and it has been exactly the right elixir for this roster. I don't know if you get into that at all, but I think it's very interesting the way he responded to all of that.
Yeah, I mean, and we do get into it a little bit. It is he has nothing to lose. I mean, that is the nice thing about
there you go. You said it much more succinctly.
He's got nothing to lose. I mean, what's the worst thing that's going to happen to Frank? They're going to pay him out for 3 years, and you know what? There's absolutely nothing to lose, and there's a certain freedom. And I think the other point I wanted to make in the piece is, you know, this has always been a very brand obsessed organization, right? They want the splashy hire, they want the splashy acquisition. Instead, what do they get? A retread who looks like an accountant who went 54-200 or whatever the hell in Orlando in a totally mismatched, weird roster and bad situation for him, right? Like, what did they do? They got the off-brand coach for the very brand franchise. And you know what? Maybe that's the secret. Maybe the Lakers are kind of learning a few things. You know, stop with the legacy hires, and you have to have the royal bloodlines from the Lakers, right? Just go out and get a guy who, by the way, will coach like he's got nothing to lose. Anthony Davis could not have been more effusive. I mean, you know, Anthony will talk now and then, and I got a chance to get him one-on-one a couple days ago, and it's like, I mean, I think 6 to 7 minutes in, he was thoroughly enjoying the conversation. He could not be more expressive for a guy who's never been all that expressive about singing the virtues of Frank Vogel. And you kind of know when a player's bullshitting and kind of just politically touting his coach, because that's what you do when a guy puts a microphone in front of you and, you know, you got to say nice things about your coach. Now, he was getting into details. Like, he was getting into specific examples. And I think that sings volumes about him. And I just think that it was a great hire, unintentionally, possibly. And look, I think Ty could have been great. I think Monty could have been great. But this turned out well, and it's ironic that it was the least Lakery hire, and I can't remember when.
I really look forward to reading the story. And I agree with you, by the way. AD is fun to talk to, and I've only done it a few times. Maybe they've just all been in the right scenarios, like on the jump, where he's sort of naturally invigorated by the environment and a couple other places. But I've always found him engaging. So, all right, look for Kevin's profile of Mr. Vogel tomorrow on ESPN.com. That's Friday. Kevin, it's always great to talk hoops with you and to talk Grizz with you, and I will see you in Los Angeles shortly.
Looking forward to it.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.